This is the Liam Sheff Show on UCY-TV and Truth Frequency Radio. In America, there's one place that we're allowed to have a fulfilling sex life, and it is in a relationship, a very special relationship. That relationship is with our, well, you have a choice, television or a computer. My name is Liam Sheff. My book is Official Stories. This is American Heretic. My other book is The Truth About Love, by the way. We in America have been saddled with the old Judeo-Christian notion that sex is shameful. In fact, some people in some religious quarters grow up simply calling their genitals their shame. Hide your shame, don't touch that, don't do that, it is wrong, you'll go blind, you'll grow hair on your palms, you'll become stupid or retarded if you give yourself pleasure by rubbing that little area of skin. Depending on who you are, I suppose it could be a slightly larger or smaller area of skin that you were given, even though we believe in a male God, he didn't give you that except as a temptation to rub so that you would feel bad about it and then we could shame you and then control your mind. Yes, we are very easily controlled through our genitals because it is a very natural urge to feel excited and stimulated in life by people who we find attractive. But it's a very easy way to control people, to say, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it, God hates you, God hates you, God hates you, you're going to hell. So we've subverted this. It's impossible to sublimate it totally. You can't actually eradicate the sex drive, and in fact we do need it to keep up the repopulation of the earth, even though we don't really need much help with that. We need it to keep up the health of the species and the continued reproduction of the species. So we've invented a number of small boxes in which you're allowed to expand and unpack your sex drive. Good luck. You can get married, which means that you take one person and in a kind of unipolar, single-pointed meditation of a relationship that starts with high hopes and ends with the dismal realization that you're a failure, and or she is a failure, because you failed to meet all of your needs at one point. Parenthetical aside, how did we become so easily deluded to think that one person could psychologically, mentally, physiologically, emotionally satisfy all of our changing needs through life, or even a day? And I'm not talking about running around screwing people, but we're allowed to read every manner of book, every version of magazine, have every variety of food. Variety is the spice of life. Eat all your vegetables. Don't eat just one thing, eat many. Avoid allergies. Don't just get hooked on one food. But when it comes to people, just have one. Get in your box. Get in your box. Close the lid. Don't ever talk to anybody else. God help you, don't flirt with anybody else and reveal your shame. Don't do it. Are you in the box yet? Yes, you are. Don't flirt outside of the box. You don't have permission to even talk with each other about getting permission to talk about flirting. You can't do it, or society will look badly at you. Oh my God, there's something wrong with you. You have a sex drive and you get excited by things and people, and you talk to them about it and you're not afraid to talk to them about it and you don't hide behind hypocrisy. Shame, shame, shame. Well, the rest of us who are healthily living inside of our boxes, afraid of actually expressing our sex drives, have, thank goodness, a media-friendly, government and church-approved outlet for our shame. And it is, again, your computer and or your television. Some of us have gotten rid of our televisions. Hello, spy plane. Some of us have gotten rid of our televisions because, well, we have computers. And computers are better than televisions because you can choose more rapidly what you're going to do. You can even interact with NSA agents pretending to be people on Facebook or Tsu or whatever network you're working on. They're there. One of them with profound Asperger's sitting in a room managing 20 or 30 screens at a time. You know what's happening in the basement over there, somewhere in the Pentagon. There is one guy pretending to be 100, pretending to be all of our best friends and collecting the nudes that we shouldn't send across the internet. What are we thinking? Anyway, we're allowed to go to the media. We're allowed to go to the media. Guilty as charged. We're allowed to go to the media, and the word masturbate might be too rough. Master view. We're allowed to master view anything that we want. For years, Tony Soprano was banging through his gumaras. We got to watch that, their full bouncy breasts going up and down on our digital screens. Now we have Blu-ray. We could see almost everything. You might even catch a little hair on an areola by accident. I guess the fluffers and peppers didn't get to it. God help us, we're mammals. You're allowed to videosturbate with your media device, your government-approved, digitally encrypted media device, anytime you want, because we're such a monogamous species. Thank goodness that you know where to put your shame. Now, some people might object to the idea that we're using media to take care of our otherwise not monogamous nature. But of course we're monogamous. We prove our fidelity to each other by getting off on everything we watch on TV. Furthermore, we sublimate our natural desire. Furthermore, might say a critic, furthermore, we're clearly not sublimating our natural desire to simply flirt with each other and find each other attractive and to occasionally talk about sex into rampant, unrestrained violence, which we enact on all parts of the world at all time, and on nature, which we seek to rape, pillage, and destroy. No, 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 no. Our sublimated sex drive in no way is taken out in the mercenary business of cutthroat, Wolf of Wall Street, heinous, psychotic crimes against humanity and the planet. No, 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 that's just the way we are. A healthy, healthy species, terrified of sex, but perfectly willing to rape the world for all of the honey that can be taken from it at all times, putting it on the market undervalued so that we can undercut the competition and then claim to be a good old-fashioned American who believes in the free market. There's nothing wrong with that. That's clearly not a result of our slightly suppressed or maybe incredibly suppressed natural inclination to just flirt with each other a little, maybe kiss a little bit here and there with some people that we feel really tender with. And in fact, we know being healthy, healthy, healthy people who respect the shamefulness of sex, that there really is only one kind of sex. It is missionary position, and for God's sake, it shouldn't last more than a minute or two. And I'm talking about getting it up, inserting it, and pulling it out. What do we think we're playing at? Are we perverts who want to have sex for a couple hours at a time in a variety of positions with conversation interspersed throughout and a lot of what's called foreplay? Why isn't it just called play-play? I don't know. Why isn't it called the intermission? Maybe it should just come, be dotted through the meal like any other condiment or seasoning. In fact, maybe the penetrative sex is the... Anyway, I'm off topic. Sex is shameful, and we know that. We know it because the culture tells us that, and it's been telling us that for 1,000 years, 2,000 years. If we want to try to find the origin of sex as shame, we have no one to look at for a better explanation than our deepest, deepest religious convictions. Yes, Babylon. Go to the Code of Hammurabi, and you'll see that if you touch somebody else's property, aka his woman, you have to give something up, either some money, or if you're not in the tribe, of course, you can be killed. This is well reflected among Christian fundamentalist groups who know that sex is shameful. That's why there are roadside bars filled with truck... filled with truck stop trollops waiting to do a service to release the pent-up pressure of the good old-fashioned American male who, God help him, just gets horny sometimes because the devil got into him, it did. The devil got into him. He goes home and tries to be a good male by putting in enough hours on the Xbox or the workout machine or just getting down to old-fashioned American work of betting, making wages on Wall Street, and never, never thinking about sex. And for God's sake, don't talk about your actual sexual fantasies with the woman or man, depending on your preference, that you're with. Don't do that. Don't open it up to reality, the fact that you sometimes get turned on by people that you know, that you really would enjoy a flirt here and there, that you secretly want to make out with so-and-so but don't want to do anything else. Is that weird? That you just want oral sex with this person that you met? Just that. You don't know why you have that fantasy, but you don't even want the other thing. Is that just too crazy? Oh my God, you shouldn't have said that. Shame, 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 shame. Oral sex is shameful. That's why it's in the movies. That's why movies have a special rating for it, so you can know, just in case you're interested in seeing what's wrong, that you can go to the multi-billion dollar industry that provides you with images for future reference and study of all of the things that we're afraid of sexually, because they are shameful, shameful, shameful. You should definitely be ashamed of your genitals and all of the impulses that run through them. That's the message that we really should live with. That's the message that drives us to warfare. Helpful, honest, depleted uranium-filled warfare to take back what's ours from those brown-skinned or whatever skin color they probably brown-skinned people who take from us our freedom, who hate our freedom because we are free. Everybody knows that we're free. That's why we have so much media that helps us resist the terrible, terrible, terrible sin of temptation that comes from having genitals at all. Oh God, why have you tempted me so? Satan, get out of my boner. Now, on the other hand, and there is another hand, there's always another hand. Sometimes you can pinch it, I suppose. It might be possible, and some people have put forward this radical notion, that sex is a normal part of life, that we get turned on because we're mammals, that a healthy sexual mind is one that doesn't restrain itself from enjoying the feeling of attraction to peers and friends and loved ones who are dear to you, who you interact with, who you care about, who you have wonderful deep conversations with, who move your heart and soul, and sometimes, and maybe it's not a sin, goes this other point of view, sometimes the natural urge, like the mammals we are, is to demonstrate some of that through affection. I know that socioeconomically it's a bad idea to go around just screwing people, it's a bad idea in terms of health because you'll get diseases, but, what if flirting and releasing some of that pent-up frustration were neither a crime, nor a cause for divorce, nor a cause to hire the lawyers to divide what you have into lighting half of it on fire and subdividing the rest among each other, including the broken pieces of children? That's what divorce is about, by the way. What if we were allowed to flirt? We were allowed to just admit, yes, we're sexual, yes, we get turned on, yes, it would be fun to think about some things and talk about them with the people who we trust. Notice I said the word trust. Notice I said the word like. Notice I said the word respect. People we like, trust, and respect. You don't have to go around giving it away. That's not liberation either. That's just reaction to suppression. That is the other point of view. My name is Liam Sheff. I have a book called The Truth About Love, in which you can read about a relatively young man's journey, asking questions about these things. My more serious book is Official Stories. This is American Heretic. If you enjoyed this message of out loud, shameful, 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 unshameful talk, put a couple dollars into the PayPal. Have a wonderful day, and don't be afraid to flirt a little bit and maybe be a human being about it. It might not kill you. In fact, it may make you feel more alive than ever. Don't be afraid to talk to your partner about being human. See you next time. Americans seem to have a fundamental misunderstanding of both sex and gender, and I would like to straighten that out as well as I can in a short video called American Heretic. My name is Liam Sheff. My book is Official Stories. This is American Heretic, funded by you. Find the PayPal link. President Obama, buried to his friends from Chicago by way of Kenya, depending on which blogs you believe and read, came out and said that a former track and a track star was very, very brave for coming out as, and this is the question that I have, as what? Coming out with a group of preppers and pimpers and fluffers, aestheticians, doctors, Botox injectors, collagen injectors, plastic surgeons, makeup artists, hair weave implant artists, coming out as a, what word should we use for a guy dressed as a girl? G-girl, g-guy, g-g, mumin, man-woman, mumin. Coming out as a mumin, I'm fine with it. Coming out as a mumin, sort of, with, who still has a weenus, or a venus, perhaps, penis, vagina. No, it's just a penis, I think. Although it may have been affected by the drugs, maybe it is a venus, I'm not sure. Who still, I believe, wants to have sex with other women. Actually, real women, not mimin, not mumin, not muman. In any case, President Obama, buried to his friends from Kenya by way of Chicago, depending on who you believe, said that Bruce was very brave. I would like to say that it takes a certain amount of courage to come out in America as something that's going to startle people, cause people to call you names, cause people to misunderstand you. On the other hand, there's a chance that you're misunderstanding yourself. And that's what I'd like to talk about. Americans are under many delusions, one of which is that there are two genders. This is not true, and there's never really been a culture on earth that imagines that there are two genders, outside of America and late Victorian England. And the English broke that rule all the time.
at Eton and Oxford, no matter what you were reading, you were probably breaking some of the Victorian sex conduct rules, which were there to be broken. Queen Victoria herself broke them all the time. Just ask her friend John Brown. We are not a two-gender species, even though we think we are, even though we might sort of look like it, depending on your point of view, even though outwardly we manifest as more completely male and more completely female. Our insides tell a different story. The inside of our psyche is neither perfectly male nor perfectly female, and we are not just dual male-female and female-male. We are intensely complex. We have layers and layers and layers of personality that can only be sussed out by something as imprecise and artful as astrology. I know some people are into the Myers-Briggs scale, which I liken in a way that should be fairly complimentary, but unfortunately isn't, as some kind of astrology, because it is a rather loosey-goosey system that allows yourself to pin yourself in and among a set of 8 different points, so that you have 16 personality types that you can come up with. Astrology does one better. And in defense of astrology, let me say that there is no form of psychology on Earth, whether Freudian, Jungian, Ericksonian, or Adlerian, any other kind, that allows us to imagine that we are one simple thing through and through, that we are, from stem to stern, nothing but an orange. We rather have layers and layers and layers of personality. We have a part of our personality that deals with aggression, part that deals with desire, part that deals with food, part that deals with food under stress, part that deals with food not under stress, part that deals with sexuality under stress, part that deals with repressed sexuality, imaginative sexuality, part that deals with work, creativity, language, part that deals with verbosity or lack thereof, part that deals with openness or lack thereof. There are so many parts of part that deals with our ability to make deals, possess that kind of magic that lets us make money in the world. There are so many parts of personality that there is no complete psychological system that can really encompass them. Astrology does better than any other kind of thing because it is imprecise, because it allows you to project a sun sign, which is what you do in the world. I'm a Gemini, I'm a communicator, I'm a transceiver, give me information, I spit it back out. I have 4 planets in Taurus, I'm cusp Gemini, Taurus, I'm a much earthier Gemini, much less prone to drug addiction and being a total fucking narcissist, sorry other Geminis, than some Geminis. I'm much earthier and more sensitive. We're dual. We have many, many natures. Oh, right, your hate. My Gemini brothers and sisters are writing me letters. What do you mean narcissistic? I'm not narcissistic. Little. Creative, though. Creative. Also drug addicted. Take it easy. No more substances. We have so many personalities within ourselves that the best we can do is to split them into pieces. So we have a moon, the holding place of our childhood self. Where we are emotionally, what we need emotionally is our moon sign. This, you can say, has no scientific bearing. Nevertheless, it works. It simply works to say emotionally I am one creature, but at work and in terms of the work that I do, I am another. In terms of the face that I present for the work that I do, I have a rising sign, which is Capricornus. It's another cusp. Therefore, I have another. People who are familiar with astrology are popping, going, yes, of course you're a Capricornus Gemini with a moon in Taurus. Of course you are. Of course you are. Absolutely, it pegs you. See? It works. You end up with different planets representing different positions of your being. One representing food and sex, Venus. One representing communication and other aspects of worldly interaction and the way you think, Mercury. One representing the way that you fight or what you fight about, Mars, Aquarius. Yeah, it makes sense. Oh my God, Liam, you're such a Mars and Aquarius. And then you can rotate that again and put that in houses. And the houses again represent the inflections of the signs that you've already gone through. Whether it's absolutely true or testable doesn't matter, because it allows the personality to be subdivided correctly because our personalities are subdivided by nature. Back to the gender issue. And it should be clear now where I'm going with this. We actually imagine that we can divide the personality, the entire personality of people, into either male or female, given what we now know based on what I've told you, and I think you resonate with, about the nature of the human being, the nature of the human psyche. Just ask Carl Jung how hard a time he had nailing down the human psyche and what it meant. Sigmund Freud, the least interesting, the least reasonable of all therapists and psychoanalogues, couldn't do more than split us into three versions of ourself, and that was too few. He was so sexually obsessed and repressed himself, he only thought that we cared about sex. Not true. If you unrepress yourself sexually, you find that you're interested in sex and talking. Both. Maybe you're interested in talking about sex while eating. It depends. Freud was a little bit right and a lot wrong. Jung was a little more right and, you know, still wasn't entirely open. Nobody can get there all the way. Least of all President Obama. Least of all Bruce. Now, in praise of Bruce, it does take a lot of courage to come out doing something you know that everybody else is against. But I'm not sure that it's as brave as it is resourceful, because to have the kind of money that he has is the only way that you come out looking girly enough. The reality is that men of a certain age look like men of a certain age. No matter how pretty you might be with makeup on, you're a man, and your shoulders and your hairy chest probably reveal it. If you have to go on chemical hormones, you begin to lose your mind. And I'm thinking about the car accident that Bruce was in that was covered up. More resources, more of a reason not to call somebody brave, perhaps. David Bowie, to me, brave. My hero, absolutely, hands down. And Joni Mitchell. I've got two heroes, Joni Mitchell and David Bowie. I love and adore them all the way, cradle to grave and beyond, because there is no stereotype that they didn't embrace for a moment just to flick it back in our faces and say, really? Sorry, we're human beings. We play in the firmament. We are bigger than all things. There is more in heaven than earth than in our philosophies and our imaginations. David Bowie decided to embrace being a female, a feminine male, a male-female, in any way that he wanted to. And he could reverse it and spin on a dime and do it again. He didn't have to get anything cut off. He didn't have to get anything put on. He could just put on a little bit of makeup and a kimono and shock the world. He also happened to be an incredible talent, a genius musician, songwriter, and lyricist. Not everybody can do that, and not everybody should have to have a good sex life. I imagine that you would have a better sex life and that Bruce would have a better sex life if it didn't involve all the makeup, if it involved, well, accepting that our gender fluidity means that as men we're going to have not just a female side, but we're going to have a variety of personalities that inhabit us from topic to topic, and a variety of topics that we like to cover that aren't included in the Marlboro Man school of male sexual identity. Hey, I know how to play the harmonica and fart. I'm a guy. Yay! You know, there's a reason that there's a high level of suicide among among cowboys. It's a very boring, lonely life in which you don't get to express yourself, so you don't have to do it. Women locked into women's roles, you know, shut up, make a pie. Nobody likes that. Nobody wants that. It's so absurd, it makes you laugh. It's absurd and insulting. Of course, my best friends are women and the men and the few men who are able to actually encounter their emotional selves and express it honestly. Otherwise, you know, you're just an acquaintance. Brave, I think, is coming out and saying that we're more than binary. We go beyond binary, and it doesn't have to do with, well, penis and vagina. It really has to do with a layer of experience and a way of experiencing life. I talk about sex, and I write about it, and so people come to me and they say, I have this fantasy, I want to talk to my husband, wife about this, I'm terrified. And I say, you know, what you said seems perfectly normal and within the range of what human beings enjoy, you know. Do you think your partner is going to accept you for it, or is it just you that are judging, heinously ridiculing yourself because you were heinously ridiculed as a child by the priest in the confession booth? We are programmed into this, by the way. I mean, you do know that. We don't grow up feeling ashamed of our sex organs. We have to be shamed by adults. Those adults get their marching orders from the Catholic Church, and sometimes Jewish fundamentalism or Islamic fundamentalism or even Hindu fundamentalism. Isn't that a crime and a shame? Maybe we'd have an easier time accepting our gender fluidity to some degree, but it doesn't mean you have to go out and screw people or fellate people or be a receptive partner in some kind of sex that you don't want to have. Maybe it's enough to know that you can love people and care about people and even find people attractive or even have fantasies that were a little off the reservation for what the Marlboro Man says you're allowed to have. Of course, the Marlboro Man smokes cigarettes, gets cancer, and dies young. As I said in my last video, John Lauritsen, a writer and journalist and really a kind of philosopher who I interviewed, told me that gay men tend to die young. They tend to die young, I think, because, as he said, they're murdered. You know, not just by people killing them, like, you know, some saint against a tree with arrows in him, or by Brandentina or something like Brandentina or something like that. But I know a woman being a man, but they're murdered in their souls, like my great uncle John Cheever, for example, who was a chronic alcoholic, who was married to my great aunt, and I never met him, but he, you know, drank himself and was probably close to death and was very unhealthy and had relationships with men that were probably more meaningful and satisfying than relationships with women, so he had to be called bisexual. So you're murdered that way, like in the movie Far From Heaven, where Dennis Quaid has to go to the bar all the time to drink and occasionally meet a guy secretly. You're murdered because you don't really get to express the fullness of your being. The problem with gay and straight is that we're much more than gay or straight, and this is the problem with gay identity. And it's even the problem with identifying as bisexual. What does that mean? Why aren't we, really? You're a door that goes both ways at any particular moment? It doesn't, n'importe quoi, it doesn't matter with whom? Really? No. America's emphasis is always on the act. You know, where you're putting it and who's putting it where. What about the intention or the feeling? What about the feeling or the desire or even the desire to think about things? We have no sense of real complex gender identity, which means that we are as complex as our astrological signs on the inside. And it's not that you're going to get, you know, we're not going to get radically turned on by something that never turned us on. On the other hand, we may feel much more whole by allowing ourselves to admit the things that we're repressing are exciting. In the ancient world, men could find men attractive and it really didn't matter. There was no bias against it. Some men were just good-looking. And if you were a girl, you might have said, I'd really like to screw them. And maybe even if you weren't a girl, you'd say, geez, if I were going to do that, that is with whom I would do it. The thought itself was sometimes enough to scratch the itch. It was satisfying enough. Women are allowed a little more flexibility this way. Men, not so much. We're not allowed just to say, yeah, I tend to go this way, but people are attractive. And again, it's beyond the sex, and I don't just want to make it seem like it's about one thing. I'll come back and talk about this some more. I don't want to get the wrong idea. I'm not looking up your skirt, or am I? My name's Liam Sheff. This is American Heretic. My book is Official Stories. My other book is The Truth About Love. If you enjoy this message of uncensored, unbridled, free-thinking, nonpartisan philosophy, please put a couple dollars into the PayPal. Thank you. Veganism. The word itself throws people into apoplectic fits of anger, terror, self-doubt, recrimination, vituperative name-calling. It's a terrifying word out on the internet today. I'm going to talk about it now. My name is Liam Sheff. My book is Official Stories. This is American Heretic. I was introduced to the concept of veganism when I was about 19. I had very naturally gravitated toward vegetarianism when I was about 15 and 16 for short periods for no reason except that I maybe had had enough large mammalian foods. I didn't become a vegan. There was no word for vegan, and the idea that I wouldn't eat some things, especially some good foods like ice cream on occasion or chicken, which was a vegetable when I was a child, didn't really occur to me. Nevertheless, people were giving up red meat. I didn't mind giving it up. It wasn't a problem. I had had enough. I had eaten so much red meat by, I think, age 11, I sometimes felt like I was having a heart attack. I remember eating a steak this big at 10 or 11 and really clutching my chest. Ow! Yes, due to all the other problems that come from digesting that much meat and protein. When I was and then I had a kind of recalcitrant or reactionary period at 18 or 19 for a number of months where I ate a lot of beef and I got as heavy as I've ever been. I'm like 170, 5'9 and change, 170. I reached 210. Is that 40 pounds? My neck was, you know, I lifted a lot of weights. Hello. And I didn't feel good. Obviously, it didn't feel good in my body. So I stopped doing that. I was at a college, one of the colleges I went to, and I walked by a little off-campus house, and they were showing a movie. It was a group called Earth Save. It was John Robbins' group. I didn't know what he was, didn't know what the movie was. It was a slaughterhouse movie. I just watched it, and I went, okay, I'm out. That's enough. Don't need to participate in that world of taking animals, stringing them up, running chainsaws through them. I can eat a different way. It's no problem. I read the book Diet for New America. I read Beyond Beef. I read any number of books about nutrition. I'd always read books about nutrition. I had been long aware of calories and of metabolism, of the basic digestive cycle, the varieties of the human body to digest things either in a very healthy way or in a way that strained it. I was aware of the digestions of digestion of fat and proteins. Was much harder for the body to turn into glucose or energy than it was to take a carbohydrate, complex or simple, and to turn that into energy. I had some understanding of basic biochemistry, physiology, etc., etc. So it wasn't a stretch for me to think that I could live without a ton of animal food, and I did so, but that wasn't good enough. I didn't just want to become somebody who lived in opposition to eating one thing. I wanted to know about food. As I said in another video, I stumbled just a couple years later, stumbled across the path, or he stumbled across mine, of somebody who had become a very important teacher to me, and I learned about macrobiotics, Chinese medicine, five element or five energy theory, a way of looking at the world through the lens of the organs of the body, their interrelationship, the interrelation with each other, and the need to support and nurture them, but also keep them from becoming, intoxicated. So I walked down that path. And that has been my path forever. I have avoided much illness. When I've had some illness, I was able to find my way out of it by adopting some new changes in diet. I had to readopt fat into my diet in my early 30s because I had been raised in a Western medical family where fat was discouraged, and I, of course, became sick by not eating fat. So I'm a big advocate of eating good fats, a real advocate of trying not to eat bad fats. You can look up what good and bad fats are online. There are pages and pages and pages. I recommend Udo Erasmus's book. I think it's Fats That Heal, Fats That Kill. Very comprehensive and well done, well appointed, nice graphics of long chain, short chain fatty acids, so you can get a kind of visceral understanding of what those are. Nevertheless, I said I was going to talk about veganism. I always hesitated to call myself a vegan because I didn't want to have a diet that lived in opposition. And when I got to know vegans, I tended to become annoyed because they didn't know anything about health and nutrition, and they didn't care, by and large, in the 90s and early 2000s. The vegans that I knew weren't concerned about nutrition. They were concerned about ethics. I understand. I'm concerned about ethics. It's a brutal thing to realize that we run chainsaws through very loving animals that give live birth after 9 or 10 months of incubation in their womb, essentially breastfeed those babies for better part of a year or so and make them very large on those mammalian hormones, estrogens and testosterone. And we just steal their babies from them, put them in crates, chop them to pieces. Of course it's brutal. It's hideous. We do it on an industrial scale. The depersonalization of it is mind-numbing. If you watch any of these slaughterhouse videos, you will wonder what's wrong with people, with the people in these places, beating these animals, prodding them, electrocuting them, anally inserting things into them to get them pregnant. It is a nightmare. It is truly a nightmare. You can watch the very clever video by one of the new YouTube video stars about how sick milk is. Of course, yes, it's weird. Making milk is weird. Drinking the mammalian effluence of some large ungulate, or if I have that right, large animal or a small animal is weird. Nevertheless, we're a weird animal, and you can understand that over the history of the human species, in various climates, in various zones, equatorial, tropical, four season, or Arctic, subarctic, you'll realize that people wanted to survive, and sometimes the only thing to do was to take some milk from an animal that produced more than its offspring needed, and kept producing if you kept milking it. Not a bad idea, and people got used to it. So it's difficult to hold eating anything against people, because people adopted the eating of animals because they were starving. That's a good reason to eat something. But of course, the land had to support what they were eating, so it is unheard of in any part of the ancient world for people to eat what we eat today. Kings eat what the poorest people in America eat today. Only kings could eat that high on the hog or the cow. We've inbred animals, we've put poison in them, their food is toxic swill, sometimes recycled animals, sometimes they're cannibals. Sometimes they're eating radioactive material, newspaper, plastic pellets. What gets fed to animals that people eat is a sin and a crime. There is every reason in the world to get away from factory farming. The Weston A. Pricers out there know this. I think they make a mistake, though, by mistaking the fact that Americans, in their halcyon version of it, get to eat like kings of yore, And the reality of what people living low on the hog or low on the land were really able to eat. That is, grains, beans, potatoes, tubers, roots, ground vegetables, all of green leafy vegetables, some nuts, seeds, frogs, grasshoppers, crickets, some rodents like guinea pigs and rabbits. Did I say fish? Every variety of fish that could be put into a lake. Sometimes lizards, depending on where you were living, and I already mentioned some insects. People have always tended to get their food from the thing that couldn't kill them just by running it down, and they did so to survive, because life was hard. The ancient Chinese perhaps best exemplify this by eating everything. Very low on the land, things that reproduced quickly were eaten, because they were there, they were available, they had nutritive value, and they couldn't be eaten in excess. When you have a lot of people to feed, one person can't eat a steak. That's the problem with the current world, the Western world, the Weston A. Price world, the paleo, the standard American idea, is that we have no notion of a limit to what we eat, because we steal from everyone to get our food. We use the majority of the world's, we use a large majority of the world's oil, at least by national size and population, to produce the food that we use to stuff into cows, to factory farm them, so that we can take some tiny, tiny increment of that that's left over as animal food and sell it for 59 to 99 cents on sale at McDonald's, Burger King, Arby's, Subway, etc., etc., etc. We could best use that food in its native form of beans, grains, vegetables, etc., to eat, to feed ourselves. And we really could, if we were serious about surviving as a species, eat local, small animals, you know, and I know vegans get upset about this, and this is the problem with veganism. I respect some vegans for their principled ethical point of view that it is, well, let's say, there should be some moral prohibition about slicing through a living animal with a chainsaw. Maybe we should agree about that. There should be some moral prohibition against violently impregnating an animal to steal its newborn calf away from it that it gestated for 9 or 10 months while it cries and moans and goes through extreme shock just to milk it, to brutally butcher its male calves and raise the next generation of females in this sorrowful state to produce more milk and more calves for us to eat like cannibals. Maybe there should be a moral prohibition against this. I think there should be. Once we get through that, and we admit that what we do to animals is brutal, and that eating the largest animals, the largest, most land-hungry, water-hungry animals, to provide us with the least amount of food, perhaps there should be some logical prohibition against that. And perhaps a logical prohibition is enshrined by a society as a moral prohibition over time. Perhaps that's why, as has been suggested by, for example, Marvin Harris, the Indians have a moral prohibition against eating cows. When you're poor, you don't eat your tractor. You don't eat the producer of milk. You treat it well. You treat it as well as you can. And that's what happens in India. They do eat cows, by the way. They eat the ones that are about to die. And there are various classes that are allowed to eat cows more than others. So you can see that a moral prohibition is there really to protect an economic interest, which means it protects the well-being of a people who aren't running a nation on oil. And if that was all too complicated, I'll say it again in another video. Because we have so much oil, we're able to eat so high on the land, so high on the hog and the cow, that defies an actual order of energy, supply and demand, thermodynamics. We actually defy what would be logically sustainable, economically, environmentally sustainable in our world. But we steal oil from certain lands, flood our land with the natural gas fertilizers that we take from there and render into ammonia onto the dead soil, and grow dead products like dead corn and dead wheat and dead soy that has no nutritional value or very little nutritional value except for the artificially mined potassium phosphate and NPK nitrogen that we you know suffuse the ground with. Vegans don't know enough about food. Maybe that's the bottom line. They don't tend to know enough about nutrition. They're getting better at it. There are reasonable arguments for a plant-based diet. Very reasonable. But a plant-based diet shouldn't be dogmatic. It shouldn't stop people from eating if they tend to produce a lot of frogs or rabbits or fish locally. They will probably eat some frog or fish or rabbit. And vegans are going to have to accommodate themselves to that in a low-energy environment. They will have to eat some insect and be very happy for it. When it's difficult to produce fats, as it sometimes is when growing plants, if you don't have a good enough environment to produce fatty seeds like, well, avocado or even seed and nut trees and bushes and shrubs, because you need a particular growing season to do it, you're going to be very happy to have an abundance of grasshoppers or fish, things that can survive in cold water. There are reasons that people eat the things that they do. The reason that we eat so much of the things that we do now is because we got oil, which allowed us to plunder the world with the immense power and energy in the abundant oil that we used to have. We don't have as much oil as we used to. That's in decline, and you can look at countries whose oil volume has declined to see what happens when it goes down. They are eating dogs and cats in the street because they're hungry. So I'm going to put forward an argument for vegans. I understand your ethical position. Now expand it. Make it about local and sustainable, and you won't have any argument from anyone, because you won't be ethically pinned to a position that you can't defend in terms of hunger or starvation or some other kind of environmental holocaust. You're going to be on everybody's side and say, let's eat locally, let's eat low on the food chain so everybody has enough. If you do that, then you can be an ethical vegan as long as we can import all the things that you eat from far away. While that lasts, you can afford to be as ethically vegan as you want to, the same way that the paleo people can be as artificially fake paleo as they want to be. On the day, or during the long or short transition that we are facing from having everything we want to having what we can only produce locally, we're all going to have to eat more or less the same thing, or serve the king who eats high on the hog, while we go back to eating grains, beans, vegetables, and anything we can catch in the stream. My name is Liam Sheff. My book is Official Stories. If you enjoyed this message of dietary philosophical journalism, please put a couple dollars into the PayPal. Remember, low in the food chain is probably a little better for you. See you next time. There are as many diets in America
competing with each other, as there are people with harebrained ideas about how to lose weight or what the new perfect food is. The Weston A. Price Foundation puts forward a rather medieval notion that the best thing you can eat is offal, guts and intestines and liver, excretory organs, brains, hearts, things that make your stomach turn a little bit, but they say that we have to get over that because that's the best thing for us. The Paleolithic people insist that we need to be eating as much, well, meat, lean meat, I think, as possible. Well, there are different schools of Paleolithic dieting. None of them, of course, come from the Paleolithic itself, which is a period unknown to us except through a few bits of remained fossilized vegetable, lentil, early barley material in the molars of early humans or even Neanderthals. Nobody really knows what they're talking about when they say paleo. There are no Paleolithic vegetables because we've hybridized all our vegetables long, long, long ago during the period of, well, the advent of farming. There is nothing from then that we eat now. I suppose you could just go try to live on fiddlehead ferns and salamanders. I suppose you'd be pretty Paleolithic then. There are the vegans who eat, well, a lot of soy and hopefully non-genetically modified soy. Certainly more soy than you probably get anywhere outside of Okinawa, which is to say that Asians have always eaten a lot of soy, and it was their one of their primary food sources, and it seemed to do fine for them as a race or group of people in holding a massive half-continent under civilization and creating a bureaucratic method of governing a great deal of China, Asia, Korea, etc. The idea that soy is a terrible, terrible problem because it contains some anti-nutrients is something that I'll get into. And then there are the moderate eaters in America, the Michael Pollans of the world, who insist that we're omnivores, but I think miss something important in that equation. In America, we have to understand things as reductionists because we are a so-called scientific nation. We don't believe in woo science, so we can't talk about energy in food. But food is, of course, energy. It is nothing but collected or collated energy that comes in through the sun and then grows through the magic form of plants that are here for reasons that no one can really explain through simple Darwinism. We seem to live in an electromagnetic universe that has a will and manifests in many forms that, you know, look to, you could say, the spiritual eye to be eternal, but, you know, that's more woo science. Chinese medicine, macrobiotics, Ayurveda, tend to look at the world in an energetic perspective. The paleo people don't, the Weston A. Pricers certainly don't, the vegans don't, and the Michael Pollans of the world don't look at the world as a series of intersecting energies. I studied macrobiotics, and macrobiotics isn't a diet, or at least it shouldn't be. Now, there are people who insist that macrobiotics is a brown rice diet, but they've entered a cult of Japanese thinking. I have a great love for Japan and the philosophies of Japan, but you shouldn't be eating as a Japanese monk unless you're a Japanese monk. But the basic principle of macrobiotics, as with our Ayurveda, is that we eat the food that grows seasonally where we live. We eat it in a combination that is pleasing to our digestion and that pleases the various cycles of seasonal energy and of the five energy systems of the body. This is very interesting. Suddenly we're in a five energy system rather than a very reductive system of don't eat this because it contains leptins and don't eat that because it contains phytates. And even though phytates are actually an antioxidant and you can get rid of these things by cooking them or soaking them, and even the amount that's so-called an anti-nutrient is vastly overwhelmed by the nutrients in the food that you eat, don't eat it because it's an anti-nutrient. One note about anti-nutrients. I find that the most undisciplined, unschooled, and unsophisticated talk coming out of people who read one notion of something about a plant or something else, and they say, well, it contains anti-nutrients, don't eat it. I hate to break it to you, but everything is an anti-nutrient in excess. Water is the chief anti-nutrient that you can consume if you consume too much of it. It will rid your body of all of its minerals and salts, and you can actually die drinking too much water. Vitamin C, a very important nutrient, is an anti-nutrient if you eat too much of it. You will shit your guts out, you will purge yourself and hold on to nothing in your body, become very sick and dehydrated. Sunlight is an anti-nutrient in excess. Leptins, then, which some people have concerns about in plants, is hardly an anti-nutrient if it's balanced with the nutrients in the plants, or if you cook it. I remember having a conversation with a former Weston A. Price chapter member who declined to continue to be because he was a little tired of the dogmatic rubric in the group, and he was railing about soy, and I said, so how do you get rid of these anti-nutrients? And he said, well, you can cook it. I said, okay, we're done. Everything is an anti-nutrient in excess. Now, what is the greatest anti-nutrient that all of the paleo people and Weston A. Price people don't talk about? The greatest anti-nutrient in the foods that they love to eat is the food that they eat. It's protein. Protein is an intense, incredible anti-nutrient. We achieve excess in protein rather quickly. The body has nothing to do with excess amino acids but break them down into amino acids, which then go through the body and rob the body of alkalizing minerals, the things that we need, magnesium, calcium, etc., to have strong bones, to have a strong immune system, to have a strong body. We rob the body of these things by eating excess protein. But these diets are built on ketosis, the idea that we should be eating excess protein. They don't consider their diet full of anti-nutrients. They miss the primary problem. Protein is an anti-nutrient in excess, and it is easy to achieve an excess of protein. In fact, they ask you to achieve an excess in protein. I predict that the long-term effects of these diets will be stones in kidneys, gallbladder problems. Well, you saw what happened to Atkins and the poor guy. I'm not trying to mock anyone, but there was a fellow from the Weston A. Price Foundation who died very, very young, although he was an intense advocate of cream and butter and eggs and raw everything, and more and more and more and more protein and high levels of saturated fat. If we decided, though, that food was energy, and we weren't going to beat each other up with notions of nutrients and anti-nutrients, but rather that food was energetic, and that we had to have food from a five-energy system, or however you want to put it, a three-energy system in Ayurveda, which is then made more complex by doubling some of them, then we might think, well, I've had some brown rice, and that's, you know, metal energy, and so I need some greens and some wood energy and some fire energy to balance that. And we might just be fine. We might actually be quite healthy. But there's another problem. We've totally destroyed our food. It's genetically modified and sprayed with petrochemical additives and preservatives and glyphosate and pesticides. We've very much damaged our food system. Our food growing system is based on mass industry rather than what we should do locally to support a healthy population. We don't have a healthy population because we don't eat food. We eat food that you could put a pH, a pharmaceutical signature in front of rather than actual ancient food. There's another even more significant problem. Even more significantly, none of us actually eat food. All of us, nobody's on the diet that they say they're on. All of us eat food that comes from one place. Do you know where that place is? The place is called a truck. I don't care if you're a vegetarian, a fruitarian, a meatitarian, a carnivoritarian, or an omnivore, you're actually a truckitarian. All of us in America are truckitarians. There's no way around that. I don't care what diet you eat. Everything that you eat comes on the back of a truck. 2.4 million long-haul tractor trailers in the United States, 24 million commercial trucks or so, bringing us everything that we eat all day long, all year long. Until when? Till there's an interruption in that most important thing that we imagine that we don't actually eat, gasoline. Gasoline and natural gas. Natural gas to make the food grow in the fields. It's turned into anhydrous ammonia, which is a fertilizer that we get from taking an oil product and spraying it on our dead fields. We're truckitarians, we're oilitarians, we're petrolitarians. We are in a shitload of trouble. Because instead of thinking about where our food comes from and whether we can sustain ourselves in the advent of an oil decline, we're busy beating each other up on useless, endless blogs about leptins and phytates and, well, whatever it is that you think is important to you. The vegans will lose, and the Weston A. Pricers will lose. And yet, only the people growing food locally will win, and that food is going to have to be the stuff that grows quickly and abundantly and provides enough nutrients so that we don't just fall off the face of the planet when we run a little lower on gas and it gets very expensive. My name is Liam Sheff. My book is Official Stories. You can support this message of, I think, independent journalism by putting a couple dollars into the PayPal. It's much appreciated. This is American Heretic.
This is the Liam Sheff Show on UCY TV Truth Frequency Radio. Please support the show by buying official stories at Amazon.
Talking about this is always gets me into trouble somewhere with somebody, but let's have a go anyway. We're not the world's most monogamous species. Now, I'm going to say up front that I'm not advocating that you not be monogamous if you're happy being monogamous, or even if you're unhappy being monogamous, I'm not advocating that you do anything without a conversation with your significant other. I'm also not advocating loose polyamory in which you do anything, let's use the word, willy-nilly, or without circumspection and great consideration. I'm instead trying to talk about the nature of the species and also the economic arrangement that we have put ourselves in the modern era, the era of petrol industry, coal, oil, and industry. Let's start with the concept of what I mean by monogamy. I don't mean to say that we don't pair bond and form long-term affiliations. We clearly pair bond and form long-term affiliations. We love people for life. Whether we can remain with them for life is almost irrelevant to the point that we are attached to people for life. We love for long, 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 long periods of time. And once we love somebody, we'll always probably think of them in that way of love and fondness. Even if you've had a terrible breakup, after the wounds have healed, you might even be mad at them because you still love them, him or her. Or it, I suppose, you could break up with. Well, that's your business. Okay, let's keep it on the human scale. Monogamy, then, isn't the idea that you don't love someone for life or that you stay with them for a long time. I don't also mean that we're not capable of being sexually, use the word, faithful. No, I want to challenge the concept of that meaning a little bit during this talk. I think that when people meet and they fall in love, they have very little desire to be with anybody else. That's part of the discovery of each other. You become enraptured by the other person's, well, person. In every aspect, you seem to delight with every turn of the leaf of personality, and even the fights reveal new depths which you can conquer together. After that bonding process is over, you may begin to realize your plan. Anybody who stays together has a project that they're going to do together, whether it's children or a business or something. Everybody who gets together and stays together has something that they do, managing a household, keeping something stable for other people, like children. These are very important things. And the human species needs things to be stable on the small scale. Couples manage to do that. But we have to admit that we are first tribal in nature, and we didn't arrive here as human beings and emerge from the from non-existence into existence as a coupling species, but rather as a tribal species. So we had many people around us who would keep the foundations relatively steady. And if one person got flaky, we had all these other people. And when this person became flaky, this person was no longer flaky, and we could always add new people. And we could have a pretty stable mat, despite individual perturbations to go through life with. So it wasn't necessarily meaningful to bond with one person for life and never look at another person. In fact, that would have been isolating you from the group and created many, many problems. Why are you isolating? We need this person. This person has to interact with all of us. Now you have to talk about sex. Why does sex have to come into it? That's a question you have to take up with, you know, the creator of all things, or whatever you think made us, Anunnaki, Yahweh, Brahma, whatever it is, or nature, or the electromagnetic force that births all things, the Tao. Whatever you think created us, made us to be a very sexual creature. And we think about sex a lot. In fact, if you're somebody in a long-term coupling relationship, you can go, and even if you're not, but you can go read the studies about people in long-term coupling relationships. They tend to feel more sexually attracted to their partner when they're permitted to flirt outside of their relationship. And even sometimes people in slightly open relationships have better sexual relationships at home. Now, that may sound absolutely distasteful to you, and I understand that. It is an uncomfortable thought to consider in the world in which we were raised, in which nobody but sluts and whores, and of course everybody when nobody's watching, thinks about that sort of thing. Of course, we all go home to our triple scoop ice cream sundae of sex on television. Nobody considers that cheating, and nobody really thinks about what that means to us psychologically, but it means a lot. It means that we can continue to be sexual creatures without violating the incredibly punitive and restrictive Judeo-Christian, well, again, that's not quite right, because the Judeo-Christian laws really only had to do with what women could do, and much less to do with what men could do. And that quality, that difference between men and women and their sexual appetites and lives was essentially embedded in Victorian constitutional analysis of what people were, and women were meant to be something, and men were meant to be something. Of course, all the trips to the doctor with the magic fingers should have proven that wrong. And the truth is, we're just a very sexual species. Now, we're very healthy and happy when we're allowed to express that. I don't mean express it, use the word willy-nilly again. If we express it without consideration, then we're inconsiderate, and we may in fact be belligerent and unwanted and really vile. But if we express it with consideration, that is, with conversation and with care and consent and, you know, in adult relationships, meaningful relationships, we may feel very, very healthy and happy. We may have a partner who is the central partner for what we do most of the time, and then have people who we feel affections for, who we feel attractions to. This is tantamount to the greatest heresy in our culture, to admit that we might have attractions and affections outside of the person that we live with. For some reason, this is difficult for us to talk about. When I say it out loud, you're probably saying, well, it doesn't seem that unreasonable that you find other people attractive, but you don't have to do anything about it. So we immediately rush back to the safety of our Judeo-Christian programming, for which we were wrapped on the knuckles and, frankly, beaten. You know, it had to be beaten into us. Don't do that or you're a whore. Don't do that or you're a whore. The guys were told, play around, sow your wild oats. The girls were tended to be told, don't do that, you're a whore. Fortunately, I grew up at times in parts of Boston, and it was quite liberated, and girls did what they wanted, and I always appreciated that. You know, if they liked you, they told you. You didn't have to play the long waiting game of the more Protestant and, you know, occluded Presbyterians, and, you know, you didn't have to go to Lake Wobegon, that kind of relationship where you just pretend, and go out on the lake ice fishing so you don't blow your brains out because you get so sick of each other. any two people, as Jean-Paul Sartre will tell you in Wicklow, or what's that called, No Exit, will tell you that any two or three people will want to kill each other in a matter of days if they only spend time with each other. It doesn't matter how engaging they are in the first hours or days of their relationship. We have a limited tolerance for other people's quirks and personalities. That's not a criticism of any particular person. It's the way we are. And we also have a lot of trouble admitting that. We think that we let people down if we say, no, I've sort of had, I love blueberry, but I've had enough blueberry for now. I need to go have some chocolate, strawberry, vanilla, paprika, whatever. Just to change and cleanse the palate. Those of us familiar with diets know that we have to change and rotate our diet on a regular basis, or we frankly become sick and deadened to the impulse of life and bored. We have to have variety. I'm not saying that you have to go screw a variety of people to be a healthy person. What I am suggesting, and I've suggested it before, is that we would be a healthier species if we, with the people that we cared about, could simply admit that we find people attractive, that people can excite and enliven us. In fact, if people don't excite and enliven us, then what in the world should? Money? Objects? I think we lose touch. As my very dear friend Benny Wills of the Joy Camp says, people in life are the prize. People is what you get. People is what we have to care about. It's very difficult for people to talk about this within relationships where there's a lot on the line, where you have several children or many children or a couple or huge debts together, huge investments, because we're afraid culturally. We've been programmed Judeo-Christianly to live inside of little bubbles in which the house is banded by the relationship, and any stepping outside of that is supposed to totally destroy that, destroy the safety of the web that you two people created so that you could support children. Well, remember, we're actually tribal, and we really are supposed to support each other, I think, regardless of, you know, once you're in a relationship for a while, you frankly owe the person that you've spent a lot of time with a certain amount of loyalty to their well-being. And I don't mean that you owe them sex. I mean that you owe them loyalty to their well-being. And should two people find that they've graduated from, you know, the school of early romance into the long school of adult responsibilities, and that they need some other things in their lives, I think that they still owe each other loyalty to that project. And that project is very often a family, but it might as well be a business. I hope this isn't too confusing or too scandalous for any of you. I think we're headed back to a more tribal way of life, come hook or crook. And I'd like us to be a little more forgiving than Leviticus and the Old Testament about it, so that we can have more adult conversations and not constantly let the old Catholics crucify us for our cares and for being human. There is a machine, a beast, waiting to eat you alive. At all times in American society, it gets into us young. It will steal your dreams, it will take your money from you, it will steal your children from you. And as soon as you fall in love, you know, and you take it seriously, and you get into a serious relationship, and you commit to it, that machine looms large and becomes quite real, and you are on the run from it for the rest of your life. That machine is called divorce. My name is Liam Schaff. My book is Official Stories. This is American Heretic. The divorce machine is something that is the opposite side of the marriage factory. The marriage factory trains us into what we're supposed to consider relationships. Relationships are those things that we get into after we've had a couple of dalliances, failures, and we've learned to find the one among the 320 million of us, or however many of us are of age in our peer group, a couple, 10 million, 20 million people who we have to choose from to be the one at any particular time in America, the one that we found to be the one forever, who is all things to us at all times. Our best friend, our best sexual partner, our business partner, our counselor, the person we pay bills with, the person we figure out how to do family planning with, the person, of course, we pay the mortgage with, we choose a house with, we decorate with. We have to have almost everything in common for mealtime. We have to have very similar diets, or it's going to become difficult. We have to get along with each other's parents, our extended clans and tribes, or that creates more problems, so that can't happen. We have to simply get along in more ways than a human being can get along with themselves. Human beings are very fractious creatures just in our own bodies. We have a million wants and needs that go in a million directions at any particular time of day. It's very difficult for people to know what they're hungry for, let alone for a couple to agree upon what they want at all times, even on the basis of food. Now, make it more complicated. Add the economic structure that makes us all slaves to the oil state. Yes, the oil state is what we truly marry when we get together in our little pod, because it's the oil state that brings us our food, our shelter, our clothing, our sense of community, that's television, and our government, that's all the things that we need are provided right there. If we rely on neighbors too much, we're considered old-fashioned and probably dangerous. Probably. We also risk being attracted to people around us, which is a threat to the marriage factory. The marriage factory says two people must be together for all time, and mostly 99.9% attracted to each other. A little bit is left for the television, so let's call it 80-20 split. You can fantasize about what's on television and then take it out on each other. If there are ever any problems in your attraction, of course, there's the therapy industry to go to. It's part of the marriage factory to go to and to talk about why you've lost that loving feeling after having three or four kids and one of you just letting yourself go in some way, or the fact that things change over time, or the fact that you've only had sex 10,000 times, and maybe you could just use a little bit of a flirt here and there, but that would be disrupting the marriage factory structure. And if the therapy industry doesn't work for you, you're left in the merciless jaws of the divorce factory. Now, a word about the divorce factory. It is populated by lawyers and narcissists. If you enter into a divorce, the divorce factory wants one of you, or both of you, to become violent narcissists very, very quickly, sacrificing anything that was ever special or sacred about your relationship to the near public humiliation of a divorce court, where you go and rat each other out for all the bad things that you might ever have done. In fact, you're rewarded for lying. Frankly, you're rewarded for making as much up as you can to defame your once eternal partner and make them seem like an antichrist on earth in any possible way that you can. Even if you've been the bad one, you're rewarded for lying about your partner. This is a benefit to what we call a narcissist, and there are many narcissists in America. In fact, America rewards nothing more than the narcissist, as the Bernie Madoff Wolf of Wall Street in general model should tell you. In fact, the whole Wall Street system is populated by people who lie to you for a living and make speculative bets on a future that is essentially based on people in other places being slaves and Monsanto being king. That's maybe a topic for a different story, but America loves narcissism, and it loves the inability to hold a conversation and come back and stay and care, even though we may have to apologize, even though we may have to work things out, and even though we may have to compromise a point of view. Americans are not trained in this middle ground, and so the marriage factory fails by design and feeds the divorce machine. The divorce machine needs to take half of your money. It needs to take tens of thousands of dollars to take a couple apart, maybe hundreds of thousands. Money meant to be paid from one partner to another will, of course, not be paid at certain times. Therefore, the divorce machine is always collecting to take people back to court, always stealing probably from the more embattled parent to throw back into the divorce machine to get a little bit of money, probably out of the worse parent, to pay for the things that were most important anyway. Not the sex life, not the idealization of Cinderella-like romance. No, that's the lie. That's the Disneyland lie that the divorce machine feeds on. The marriage factory says Cinderella and Prince Charming are together happily ever after, forever and ever. But there is no next day in the Cinderella story. We should really have stories about what the next day looks like in our fairy tales. We should really have all of the varieties of marriage listed when we decide to get married. A word about the varieties of marriage. We're told that marriage is one thing, forever and ever, love you forever and ever till death do you part, forsaking all others, of course, except, of course, television, photos, advertisements, everything else that screams to us of sexuality, that titillates us, and gossip, our favorite American pastime, talking about the lives of others, something the East Germans were very fond of, something that we do all too much. We become titillated and excited about the lives of others because we're not living our own lives, because we're not permitted to live our own lives, which would probably involve a little more flirting and a little more happiness, then we're permitted in the marriage factory, and we don't want to risk going to the divorce machine, so we just pretend that we don't and we gossip about those who do. Marriage, what's the line? Never to the marriage of true minds admit impediments, but there are always impediments. People are so complex that we can't get along with ourselves at any particular time of day. Our stomachs go one way, our minds go another. We don't keep the promises to exercise more or less or work harder or fewer hours than we said that we would. So why should we be exactly mentally locked in with any one person at all times of day, all day long? It's an artificial construct that is built to fail, thus feeding the angry, blood-soaked maw of the divorce machine, which is what it wants. The lawyers are there saying, yes, come on in with your tears. Oh, it sounds so terrible. God forbid you two should be able to talk like adults. Let's take it all apart. Here, sign over half of everything. That's for us. And then you guys fight among the rest, and the kids will be scarred forever because we misunderstand what marriage is for. In the ancient world, marriage was a very, very different animal. To get a divorce in Rome simply meant walking up to your partner and said, I'm divorcing you, and or maybe mildly petitioning for it at different times in the empire, and then you were divorced. Children, of course, are always children of a family. Tribally, you can't get divorced in any meaningful way because you can't get married in any meaningful way. In many tribes around the world, marriage is hanging your hammock in somebody's hut for a period of time. The children are never subject to your divorce should you decide not to be a happy couple forever and ever, should you decide you really work better as friends or co-hunters or business partners or co-farmers, but not as a eternally romantic couple. The children are not punished. The children are the children of the tribe, the family, the extended family. The children don't have to go live in one person's hut or the other. They grow up in the tribal land. This is something that we, well, to use the word, evolved with. We're very used to it as a species. We're not used to the structure of living in isolated lifeboats, these things we call suburban apartments and houses, which have to be divided in two should people not get along well enough. You put on the plastic happy face all the time so that you don't have to go into the divorce machine. Marriage comes in a variety of colors. Some of those are the early kind, the romantic flavored zeal, where you're just full of love for each other and every new moment is a discovery of each other's passion and magnificence. That tends to give way to the discovery of each other's humanity, the shortcomings that you face with each other in some way or another. Somebody's different in this way and that way, and there's nothing you can do about that because people themselves are different from themselves through periods of life. How will you not be different from somebody else through periods of life? It's a myth. The marriage factory imbues us with this myth, with its Disney movies and its Cinderella medieval fantasies, which are all really sold to make, in many ways, women happy, being subservient in the home, in many ways, men being slaves in the field. It doesn't have much to do with us as actual people in the way that we relate to each other over time. It certainly has nothing to do with grown-up, emotionally mature friendships in which people communicate their needs over time, the complex nature of their relationships over time, through words carefully chosen to best represent what we're actually feeling and be as unvindictive, as least vindictive as possible. We aren't trained in that kind of communication. So when that magical early phase ends, we grasp at it and we paint the face on. We're fine, everybody, we're fine, okay. Then you go to the therapy. You go to the therapy industry. If it doesn't work out well enough, if we're having some problems, we're only having sex once in a while, well, we better go to therapy. Maybe the marriage factory has actually conditioned you to think you need to go to therapy. Maybe you're functioning in an entirely normal way. You've become wonderful business partners and managing the household and the children. You know everything about how to manage that household and those children, and you're good at it. But you've become a little distant. You don't have the energy to fulfill those adolescent needs, and I'm not putting them down, but those early romantic needs that shouldn't go away through life. Maybe those romantic needs would be better spent doing a little bit of off-campus flirting here or there, outside of the reservation, and remembering the obligations you have to the home, remembering that you're tribal at root, tribal in nature, and that your tribe is always your tribe. And if you happen to develop other important relationships, they'll have to be weighed as to whether they're good enough to be in your tribe over time. You begin to see that you don't have to give in to the divorce machine if you begin thinking a little more tribally. You don't have to give in to some sort of redolent polyamory in which you're leaping from partner to partner very, very quickly either. You can have something that Americans don't understand, which is a sane middle ground. You can actually have a middle ground which you test first in conversation. If the marriage factory weren't so severe in the penalties of the divorce machine, we might be able to have happier relationships over the continuum of life. We might be able to support the children that we made in the early zesty part of the relationship through the business part of the relationship, in which we become very good, solid friends and business partners. Instead of looking at marriage as a failure when you reach the nature of good business partners, you've actually achieved what happens in every tribe. And maybe it's time to allow some flirtation or other extracurricular, whatever it is that moves you, whether it's internet flirting or if you're very brazen, you can allow each other to have good friendships outside that are respectful still of your tribe, of raising the children. You could actually try that. It would take some consideration. It would take you disbelieving Mother Church and State and the rules that it has created for you to become an isolated pod among a sea of people who could be your friends and co-tribal people. And I don't mean that in a sexual way. I mean they could be heart-to-heart co-tribal people who help you raise your tribe as you help them raise their tribe in your communities. But no, the marriage factory isolates you. The Judeo-Christian and even Hindu marriage factory isolates you, says you're all alone. You pay your bills on your own or you're a failure. Don't rely on anybody for anything. Mother, church, and state have your back if you obey the laws, and if you don't, you have to go to the divorce machine and let them humiliate and shame you, turn you into angry, selfish, betrayed, belittling, or narcissistic people, either victims or victimizers, just so that you don't have to end up parting with everything that you think that you've earned. Yes, America loves to create narcissism. People who will not take a middle approach in communicating. People, it's all right or all wrong. There is no middle ground. No, we can't just say things didn't work here and we'll make them okay here where they seem to function okay. And yes, we can both work on these issues a little bit. We don't like to do that here. We're either all right or all wrong. We're either Beyonce the superstar or, well, every nobody who isn't her. We don't seem to have a rational basis for an understanding of self. We have a marriage factory that lives in Disney mythology. We tell children things that we would never tell ourselves. You're either an absolute success or an absolute failure. Is life really like that? Don't all of us live in some middle ground, having not achieved many of our dreams, having been disappointed? What did Paul Simon say? I don't know a dream that's not been battered. I don't know a friend who feels at ease. Isn't it true of all of us that our dreams have been battered a little bit and that we are ill at ease a lot of the time? But we're also okay a lot of the time when we find our friends, those people who forgive us our flaws and hang out with us even though we're kind of screwy sometimes and then tell us, we could, you know, I'll hang out with you, but you gotta just calm down a little bit here, or maybe hang out with me when you're in this mood but not in this mood. We don't allow ourselves that in the marriage factory. And so the divorce machine sucks people dry and murders them in their own lives. I see it all the time. It is a tragedy. My name is Liam Sheff. This is American Heretic. If you like this message of independent, well, philosophical relationship thinking, you can put a couple of dollars into the PayPal kitty. My book is Official Stories. See you next time.
There are some people, and they are relatively few by percentage, who believe that religion is true. There are many people who believe that they are religious, but they don't believe the former. This should show you what a complexly obdurate, hypocritical, self-deluding, self-delighting species that we are. I'd like to talk a little about the difference between people who are a little bit religious and people who believe that religion is true, and I'd like to offer a possible solution to the problem. My name is Liam Sheff. My book is Official Stories. My other book is The Truth About Love. This is American Heretic, funded by you. Religion is a series of stories. The stories seem to mirror each other throughout time, throughout societies, across cultures, across continents, from islands to archipelagos, to peninsulas, to great continents. We always have dying and rising gods, gods that represent the harvest, gods that represent the grain, gods that represent the gourd, goddesses and gods that represent the sky, the warriors of the sky, the decapitated, head-birthing, leg-birthing, thunder-hurling animus, the souls of the heavens. The stories are the same all over the place, and people like Fraser, the Golden Bough, I believe, and Joseph Campbell, of course, in his many, many books and famous video series with Bill Moyers. Let's see, who else? There's a great book on India. The name escapes me right now. Alan Watts, to some degree. Anyway, they're the integrators across the cultures, who say there isn't just one God. There isn't just one God of Earth. There isn't just one goddess of the moon. In fact, across all the cultures, there are reflected the same set of gods. Once you bite onto this hook, it's impossible to look at religion the same way again. And you become somebody who is, well, perhaps a mythicist, on the sort of more academic side of things, you could call yourself agnostic, which I find to be a little bit unconvincing, a little uncommitted. Mythicism, though, is the study of the gods across many cultures. On the other hand, you may have been conditioned to believe that any story that isn't your story is tantamount to a failure of your faith to believe the story you were told when you were growing up. This is, of course, a kind of mind conditioning by fear. If you ask questions and you doubt, you are out of the tribe. This threat with being excommunicated is enough to make most people, when they're very young, believe and go to Sunday school and say, "What do you mean, swallowed by a whale? Like Pinocchio? No. I don't know. What? We get cookies? Okay. Spectacles, testicles, wallet, and watch." When we get older, most of us encounter academia. Most of us encounter myth. Most of us encounter so many stories of literature, of the English novel, of the Russian novel, so many pieces of art and music, all celebrating the various Greek gods, Roman gods, some hearkening to Babylonian, Assyrian, and Egyptian ideas and idealizations. We listen to Holst's The Planets, and we are so moved by the power and grandeur of the music of the spheres that Holst was certainly channeling, that it's impossible for us to grip white-knuckled onto a fearful belief in an angry Yahweh or Allah. But somewhere inside, our little child's hands are still gripping on to that little belief, and we're saying, "Oh, no, 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 no. I'll just hold somewhere in the back of my head not to do all the things that they said to not do, or at least if I do them..." Whoops, I looked at Playboy again. Although there are no... Why? Why, Playboy? Why? "I'll just cross my..." Okay, I'm fine. Religion, then, I have said, is... I mean, pure religion, pure fundamentalist religion ends up, without anybody intending it to be the last refuge of scoundrels. Because the only people who cling to absolute religion, obdurate, inflexible religion, recalcitrant and inconsolable religion that refuses to open its mind a little bit, tend to be people whose lives have become very dissolute, whose lives haven't gone the way that they want to, and so, or who've been behaving very, very badly. You never go to a born-again revival tent, for example, and find CEOs of companies that are doing very, very well, happy, very happy homemakers with wonderful lives and incredible sex life and a lover on the side that they're not telling anybody about because it's really their business and aren't they in charge of their life anyway? And I saw in National Geographic that the Maasai do it, so if they can, why can't I? You never go to a revival tent meeting and meet people who are extraordinarily happy. Fundamentalist religion seems to draw people whose lives have gotten away from them, who've done things that they regret, who are unable to manage an addiction, who are unable to manage their behavior towards others. And they go to that thing that they're reminded of when they were young, and they say, okay, I'm going to go and stick with this. This will be salvation. It's worked for so many people. It must. Maybe it'll work for me. When you try to get out of that, you face the process of education and of disillusionment. Disillusionment with the idea that we lie to children, and we do. Santa Claus, Jesus, Allah, whatever. We lie to children all the time. It's not very nice, but we do. It's a terrible trick we play to recapitulate the lies of our childhood on our children, but we do it. Some parents will opt out and say, no, I'm not going to tell them in absolutes. We're not going to celebrate Christmas and have Santa Claus. Other parents look upon you as though you're a child abuser by not lying to your parents and stealing their mental virginity with a crushing blow of, no, it was Mom and Dad, we bought you that shit. You know, I can tell you, I would have much preferred my mother just to say, Santa Claus is a myth that we tell to represent how hard we work for each other when we give each other something on this Saturnalia at the end of the year when we celebrate the darkest point of the year, the equinox, the solstice, I mean, when the sun is as dark, the sky is as dark as it will ever be, and the hours of daylight are as short as they ever be. We give each other a gift in remembrance of spring. And this is what I'm giving to you, working at the job that I hate so that you can have a plastic piece of shit made by George Lucas's company. Happy Saturnalia, whatever. I would have much appreciated the truth knowing that my mother had worked very hard for something than the idea that if I crossed my fingers and pretended not to do anything wrong because somebody was watching me all the time, that I would get a Millennium Falcon. Ooh. There are people who believe absolutely in religion, and there are people who don't. Most people don't, but they still consider themselves religious. Now, why do they consider themselves religious if they don't still believe absolutely in religion? This is the cop-out, and this is the problem with the world. We really should have a threshold at which you have to call yourself no longer religious. So, if we go into the Old Testament, or the Torah, as it, the artist formerly known as the Pentateuch, and we take it seriously, we look and we see celestial light shows, creation events from darkness, talking snakes, Elisha giving birth to a sequel, Elijah by dropping a double portion of his ice cream cone soul down onto the planet because the Jews needed a sequel. We all love Superman stories. Give us another, give us another, give us another, 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 another. Is Deadpool 2 out yet? How about Captain America 4? Could you just shoot him back to back? I hear they're making another Transformers movie. God, I'll never get enough of that. We love sequels. We love superhero stories. If you really imagine that the ancient Jews were any different than the modern Jews or the modern Christians who are super modern Jews with Superman tacked onto their Judaism, Jesus being Superman, if you didn't understand what I was saying, if you really think that ancient people didn't love superhero stories in which they embodied something unknown in the characteristics of a narrative, then you've got another think coming. Do you really think that Beowulf was an actually literally true story? And that a man fought a monster and then its dragon mother? Do you really believe that Enkidu and, Gilgamesh and Enkidu was an actually literally true story? And Gilgamesh swam to the bottom of the ocean to find Utnapishtim, the only one who had survived the worldwide flood to learn the secret of immortality, which was swimming to the bottom of an ocean and finding a plant. Do you really believe it's literally true? Most people don't, but they believe that, but again, that small minority who get a little bit lost along the way have to believe that the story of Moses is literally true, or they're not true believers. Most Christians, though, and most Jews, are secular. That means that they accept, and this is the confusing thing, that the thing that they want to think is true and the thing that they don't want to think is true doesn't have to be true. This is the birth of chronic, constant mental dislocation, a kind of inflammation of the non-reality zones of the brain, that all Americans, Europeans, Africans, Asians who buy into Christianity or Judaism or Judeo-Christianity or Islam must accept. We must accept as secular people that some of these stories are clearly mythologized, like Spider-Man is a mythologization of the nuclear age, of a fear of nuclear power, transferred from a nuclear experiment and a spider that bites a kid. So we have the hero's journey, the coming of age journey, we have Achilles and Odysseus kind of in one, and then we have the invisible, the Archon, we have the energy principle that is the wild, untamed nature in the nuclear bomb, we have Godzilla, we have the Incredible Hulk. How many things can the atomic bomb give us? Well, that's what all of the golden age of American comics were about. Just as the age of Greek comic heroes, well, I'd like to talk about that, Zeus, Hera, Mercury's, Mars, all of these were about something. If our gods are about the mixture of our fear and misunderstanding and worship of science and technology that meets humanity at some point, then what were the ancient gods, including Allah, including Yahweh, really about? There's a group of people that I want to talk about in my next video, and I will call them the people who worship Saturn. There are people who believe that Saturn was our primordial sun, that Mars and Venus were ejecta from our previous solar system, and that we once witnessed in the sky an intense celestial bombardment and battle of electromagnetic wreaths and cocoons around large bodies, interacting and interjecting, effusing all over each other to a degree that was breathtaking here on Earth and looked like what are described in the ancient myths as the thunder gods, the gods of thunder, earth, lightning, sky, the god of earthquake, the god of the undersea, the god of the tidal wave and the typhoon. There are those who can make a very good argument that celestial, upper atmospheric, plasma events, reproducible in small volume in laboratories, reproduced in things like the Carrington and Tunguska events, again I'll do a whole video on this, are what we're really talking about when we talk about the ancient gods. Interesting idea. And it would make Judaism sit back on its heels a little bit and say, wow, the creation of the earth might not have been the creation of the earth, but rather the separation of earth from a different period of planetary history. Can't prove it, not going to argue it right now. Let's just say, though, that we have these ancient stories that mythologize what may have been atmospheric events. If it's too out there, believe me, I understand. Believe me. I'm not saying it's true or you have to ascribe to it, but I'm saying it's worth thinking about. If the ancient gods were the comic book iterations of upper atmospheric massive plasma events that tore the sky, tore the earth, shattered our perception of reality, caused rain for months, we may end up with stories of 40 days of rain and worldwide floods as created by a particular deity. Now, the modern religious person, of course, who rejects these stories because they're unreasonable scientifically, may in fact be wrong. These stories actually may be the birthplace of the thing that they believe in. They may believe in an overseer god, somebody they have to pray to, worship to, or the late Roman invention of a sequel, a sun god who comes back and represents the solar deity much more than the, well, whatever Yahweh really represented, the earthquake deity. And so we have the people who believe that Jesus had to have been a real person instead of what it really looks like in Roman history, which is a series of movements meant to take Judaism away from the Yahweh worship and really pin it onto a more progressive, frankly, kind of self-directed Gnostic, to use that word, self-knowledge worship. we don't allow, we don't have a line in the sand that says, after this you can no longer be Christian. And that's a problem, because most Christians don't really believe the literal, so-called historical version of the Pentateuch. And most Jews don't either. I really think that we should clarify that line, and let us forgive ourselves for simply being open-minded and secular, understanding that the universe is at root a mystery and not explicable by anything, so that we don't have to name it and pin ourselves to a series of rules that came along with an old tribe a long, long time ago. I'll be following this up with what I promised. My name is Liam Sheff. My book is Official Stories. This is American Heretic. Put a couple dollars into the PayPal to keep these interesting messages coming your way. Thank you. I once interviewed John Lauritsen for an extended period of time. One of the things he said that always stuck with me was that gay men had always died young. I didn't really understand exactly what he meant. I had an idea. In time, I understood it very, very well. My name is Liam Sheff. My book is Official Stories. This is American Heretic. It's always sobering to wake up to a massacre. I don't really know who to blame. Nobody can figure out what's true in the media. Nobody can figure out what's true regarding terrorist organizations. They seem to be assembled. Later, we find out by one of the MI groups over in the UK, maybe there's a little bit of FBI or CIA help that is admitted to in some page of some journal somewhere, and maybe that's how some people got some things they shouldn't have had that made the terrible thing happen, but it's too late. We always blame the Muslims. I suppose we might as well blame the Jews for inventing a religion that the Muslims could borrow from. I suppose we have to blame the Christians for supporting the invention. Who knows when it ends? Nobody can really explain why people believe things that are historically so dubious and contradicted by something we might call evidence or generally accepted facts determined over long periods of time. But there it is, we're a myth-making species. In Florida, a number of people were killed. 50 is the number in the news right now. It's awful, it's nightmarish, and it's terrifying. This will lead the media blitz for the next months. All you will see is gay pride and gay sorrow and gay rights, rights, rights. And a pushback from liberals who think that they're supporting gay rights by, and then the politics are up for grabs. Do you ban guns? Do you ban Muslims? Do you infiltrate any group of people who are worshiping something that's obviously an historical fiction, a myth? Depending, are we going to go into Christian churches because they also worship the forefathers that the Muslims worship? How far back do we take it? How much fiction can we excoriate from the human brain to make it make sense? We're clearly not a logical species. My heart goes out to everyone. I want to talk about a different kind of genocide. In 1987, there was a study called the Concord Trial. The Concord trial tested a drug called AZT. AZT had been a chemotherapy drug that was very, very toxic. It didn't make the chemotherapy market. It was too toxic. It caused liver damage and it caused death. It suppressed the production of blood cells in the bone marrow. Not a nice drug. There had been some gay men, a good number of gay men, who had been sick, so-called mysteriously, and died. Actually, in the beginning, they thought it was related to what they called lifestyle, not being gay necessarily, but taking tons and tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of drugs, putting benzene into their colons and absorbing that into their body, using poppers and nitrite drugs and huffing them, a carcinogenic drug leading to Kaposi sarcoma, destroying the lungs and leading to pneumocystis carinii pneumonia. There had been pretty good analysis of it that led to a multifactorial toxicological spectrum. It didn't suit some people within the gay power structure to be blamed essentially for getting sick, so they changed the story. By changing the story, they decided that it was a sex disease, and by making it into a sex disease that had a known vector that whose name was changed, whose identity was never really nailed down, for which a test was made that came up positive for everything. In the medical literature, we now call that an HIV test. And only use it on certain groups of people. More on that in a moment. They needed a drug, and they gave the world the drug that had been the failed chemotherapy drug. The drug, zidovudine, was put through a trial, the Concord trial. Out of the 172 people who died during the trial, 169 of them were on AZT. The trial was rushed through. The FDA approval process was corrupted and bankrupted. It has never been the same. Due to protests and outcries to get us something faster, the normal, slow, tedious, more careful approval process for drugs was overturned for all time. Fast-track approval would now be the order of the day. AZT was dropped into the market. The death rate in gay men skyrocketed. It went from about 12,500 a year. The death rate was on the decline as gay men pulled back from some of the more extravagant behavior of the gay ghettos. Not from being gay, but from some of the more extravagant, perilous behavior of the gay ghettos. Not a particular sex act, but the volume followed by the number of drugs, pharmaceuticals, antibiotics, rendering their guts paper thin, giving them every disease that could be gotten by having no functional immune system, that's the gut. By destroying the functional immune system, that's the gut, you get every disease in the world. No, AZT would be the new cure. It spiraled the death rate out of control from about that 12,500 in 86 to into the 20s, 30s, then 40,000 people per year dying all the way through 1994, 1995, at which point the medical establishment said, whoops, AZT seems to be, here are their terms, poorly tolerated. Let's cut back the dose from 1,000 or 1,500 milligrams at very high doses to 100 milligrams and make it part of a larger drug cocktail. We'll put in some other drugs that will eventually redistribute the fat on your body, give you humps, make your arms skinny as toothpicks, but you'll be fine. At least you won't be dead from AZT. I mean, from the other thing that we don't have a test for. The death rate from AZT cumulatively is hard to measure, but if you add the years, you're well up into the 200,000s. I believe Celia Farber wrote about this extensively. John Lortzen wrote about it. There's so many good people who wrote about it who had their careers in journalism destroyed by the medical mafia, the real terrorists in the room. Joan Shenton has made film after film about it. They are ignored, they're excellent, and they're ignored. They're as good as anything, they're much better than anything made about global warming or saving the seals or any other thing that goes forward. They're as good or better than Gay Sex in the 70s, a movie which I recommend that you watch to see what was happening in the gay community in the 70s, how sick people were getting before they had a disease determination because they were staying out exhausted and doing so many fucking drugs. Antibiotics. Paupers. A friend of mine recently got a little bit sick. He's a gay man. He felt it was a great mystery as to why he was sick, and slowly he admitted that he'd been doing paupers for about the better part of 9 or 10 years, intensely for a year and a half. Finally, a friend of his and I were able to focus his attention on that aspect of his life, and by focusing on nutritive rehabilitation, apparently he's been doing much, much better. But it's very hard to get gay men to admit that the stuff that they do in the clubs, night after night, year after year, can have a cumulative toxic effect, just like the cumulative toxic effect of vaccines, the cumulative toxic effect of glyphosate, of GMOs, of whatever they're spraying in the skies, of the stuff that they put in the water, has on all of us. Gay men take it in larger doses because they're an isolated, ghettoized community. On the inside, they have the pharmaceutical terrorists who tell them that their only way out of being hated by the insane fundamentalist right-wingers in the Judeo-Christian Islamic world is to trust the insane fundamentalist, pharmacidal, homicidal maniacs, the Robert Gallows of the world, the nicer versions, the Luc Montagniers, who try to soft-pedal it, the Jay Levies who try to soft-pedal it and make it nice, the Don Abrams who try to soft-pedal it and make it nice, but they all know, at least some of those guys know, that what they did, what they witnessed, was a mass, well, is it a genocide if you're taking the pill and it kills you, or is it a murder-suicide? It's very difficult to know what to label it. The gay community is now very busy taking something called PrEP, Truvada, pre-exposure prophylaxis. It's another black box label drug that they take before they're sick or before they get a fake HIV test result. No, they're not positive. They just take it because through a variety of stunt tests involving monkeys and macaques and every other bit of pharmaceutical laboratory stunt making that you can do, they rushed through the idea that you could convince people to take toxic, black box labeled chemotherapy drugs so that you don't get a test result that has no specific meaning. Stockholm Syndrome, meet gay community. I only know one journalist who bravely covers this issue to this day. I occasionally reflect some light back on it, but TerryMichael.net has covered this for years. Years and years and years. He is a gay man looking at the gay community, an elder in the gay community, saying, "What the fuck are you doing? Can we read the fine print?" Now, on the other side, you have the true maniacs of the world who believe ancient mythic stories give you the right to go hurt people. It's impossible to know for me, as a non-insider to the intelligence community, what's true when something goes absolutely batshit crazy and it involves ISIL, ISIS, or any other version of Islam, because it has been admitted that the FBI has worked in connection with some of these groups to get them the stuff that they used. It has been well understood since 9/11. Well, that's another story. Your heart should go out to everyone, but the gay community has a genocide that it doesn't acknowledge. It pretends that hundreds of thousands of gay men that it memorializes in the AIDS quilt and in patent fictions like the movie Philadelphia, in which a guy goes and has one incidence of sex and then mysteriously gets sick. It's not what happened in the clubs. That's not what happens in the clubs. Patent fictions saying that all of these men died from a mystery vector that can't be isolated, purified, or shown to cause any particular problem, certainly can't be tested for. It was AZT. You want to know the terrorist? It's GlaxoSmithKline. It's Abbott Labs that makes the tests, along with all the other test makers. It's Robert Gallo, who's been made a millionaire so many times over by pre-selling a totally fraudulent test to Abbott Labs before he had even published a peer-reviewed, whatever that means to you, paper on his bold assertion that something he stole from a French lab was the cause of something that was multifactorial, that could in many cases be reversed by stopping the toxic load, and that was never helped by giving people black box labeled failed chemotherapy drugs that kill them, suppress their bone marrow, and killed the names that we remember: Arthur Ashe, Rock Hudson, Freddie Mercury, Keith Haring, Ryan White, a 12-year-old hemophiliac who was put on AZT. These are AZT, AZT, AZT analog deaths. AZT is the terrorist. GlaxoSmithKline is the ISIS in the room that we won't talk about because we trust science, not religion. Because religion will make people crazy enough, maybe, I don't know, nobody can tell you what's true, to go into a club and kill people. Awful. And now the media will be abuzz and ablaze with the idea of managing the Muslims and managing the fundamentalists. If you really are serious about this, why don't we just outlaw religion? Because it's crazy. Why don't we just outlaw the belief in absolutely true science while we're at it? Because it's absolutely crazy. Why don't we just outlaw absolutism and decide that we must decree open-mindedness? There it is. We must decree open-mindedness. You know what? It won't work. Because people aren't rational, by and large. I'm really heartbroken. God damn it. Fuck. I'm really heartbroken for what happened in Orlando. It doesn't take away what happened from 1987 to 1995 and what happens today in the gay community. My name's Liam Sheff. This is American Heritage, my book's official story. See you next time. Thank you.
My name is S.M. Gibson, and I am the host of Anti-